This is a CBC podcast. If you just can't get enough CBC, make sure you check out our shop online. Discover music, books, clothing, and accessories at cbc.ca/shop.
Hi, I'm Matt Galloway. This is the Metro Morning Podcast for Monday. Coming up, the Chief of Police, Bill Blair, on why some of his officers did not cooperate with an investigation into their conduct during the G20 summit. We'll hear reaction to the latest WikiLeaks release from this past weekend, and as well, how the Art Gallery of Ontario is opening its doors and reaching out to different communities. It's a big step for a gallery like the AGO. We'll tell you about it when I meet the woman who's responsible for that coming up on the program. First, the Chief of Police. No charges. As you may have heard, that decision came down late last week from the province's Special Investigations Unit regarding police actions during the G20 summit. The SIU was investigating 6 complaints against officers who worked during the G20. The unit decided none of those officers will be charged with using excessive force, despite the fact that there were, quote, reasonable grounds to believe excessive force had, in fact, been used. Bill Blair is the Chief of Police for the City of Toronto. He's with me now. Chief Blair, good morning.
Good morning, Matt.
So, reasonable grounds to believe excessive force was used, but no charges. What does that say to you?
Well, let's go back to the term reasonable grounds. The SIU, in their press release, I haven't seen their investigative documents, they haven't released them to us yet, but in their press release, they said that they had reasonable grounds to believe that the police had used excessive force, and they used and pointed to their evidence as corroborating this, a YouTube video. I've had that video examined. It's been tampered with. There is a significant segment of that video that has been edited out. It's quite apparent, actually, when you're watching the video. And when the SIU is relying on tampered evidence, on essentially a fabrication as the corroboration of their assertion that there are reasonable grounds to believe, I think it really calls into question the quality of their investigation.
If you think the video was tampered with, wouldn't the SIU be able to figure out that the video was tampered
with? They certainly should have before they pointed to it as their corroborating evidence and shared it with the media. It's posted on your website. It's been used by the media across this country as corroboration that, in fact, excessive use of force was used by the police. But the evidence that they're relying on is false. It's been edited. There's a significant portion of it has been removed. And I think that portion, I think, removes any opportunity for a reasonable explanation of the force that was used. And frankly, I would have expected more.
Perhaps the evidence that the SIU had would have been more substantial had the officers actually cooperated with this investigation. 2 of the officers involved in the case, who are identified as having something to do with this incident, refused to testify to the SIU. Now, that's their legal right. But what does that say to you?
It says to me that they exercised their legal rights.
But it also says that they refused to cooperate with this investigation.
No, the SIU named them as subject officers. Subject officers means that under law they have certain responsibilities and certain rights, and they exercise those rights. An investigation, we run into this all the time. It's one of the things that the police do, Matt. We investigate allegations of criminality and what we don't do is rely on fabricated evidence that clearly has been doctored to create a certain impression. And I think, quite frankly, even a cursory examination of that video determines that it has been significantly tampered with.
But you do rely on witnesses to come forward, and presumably you would want – I mean, these officers weren't able to be identified because they weren't wearing name tags.
Well, that's not entirely true either. I've, again, viewed the video, and I'd invite you to go do it, and it's easy to find.
I have
seen it. You've
posted
on your website. And there's no way to determine from the video that it was the distance it was with whether or not they are wearing their name tags.
But there are other officers around. And so the other officers who are around could have said, yes, this is this person, this is not this person. Those officers refused to testify.
Yeah.
So that might be their legal right.
But I think what those officers were in the middle of, Matt, was arresting a violent armed offender. And of course, the use of that weapon has been removed from that tape. But in the middle of that fight, the opportunity for the officers to identify the actions of individuals, I think, would have been extremely difficult.
Just sounds to a lot of people like that old phrase, the blue wall,
well,
which
you know,
officers
what?
Protect themselves.
Well, let's talk about the truth. Let's talk about some facts instead of tampered evidence. And that's essentially what we're dealing with.
But again, wouldn't the evidence have been more fulsome had the officers cooperated with the investigation itself?
Well, the officers cooperate to the extent that they are required by law to submit their notes, and they do. They submit certain other reports. What they did not do is give a statement to the SIU. The ones that are named as subjects, the ones that are named as witness officers, did give statements to the SIU and did cooperate in that investigation. But again, the SIU director is not relying on their testimony or their evidence or the statements that they gave. He's relying for his corroboration on a doctored video. And frankly, I think Ontarians, certainly the police, but all Ontarians, have a reasonable expectation that they will get objective and competent investigations from the SIU. Public confidence in the police, public confidence in our criminal justice systems depends on that objectivity, on the thoroughness and competence of their investigation.
It also depends, though, on officers playing ball. And I would suggest that this actually goes beyond this initial investigation. Have a listen.
I think this is the only incident where they've been able to point to evidence, as the SIU director did in his press release, and said, this is the corroboration, but it's false.
Mm.
And so I think we've really got to go back to, you know, there were thousands of video images of police officers doing a very difficult job in the face of enormous provocation. There are thousands of videos where police officers are being had things thrown at them, where they're being attacked,
right,
spit upon. None of that was relied on by the SIU. The only thing they relied on in this case was a single incident, a single video clip. They point to it, they speak very specifically to it, and they released it to the public, saying this was their corroborating evidence. It's false.
I'd like to go back to something that you said earlier, which is that police officers do these sorts of investigations all the time. This is a comment that one of our listeners made about gathering evidence in these cases and beyond. Have a listen to what was said.
Hi, Patricia Chartier, Toronto. I'm just wondering why some of the fellow officers don't come forward with evidence against their peers, the same way they're always calling on the youth of Toronto to do so in the event of a crime committed by a teenager. Why should we expect more of the youth if the police themselves set such a poor example? Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's a call from Patricia. Again, we spoke earlier last week with the unit commander for Jane Finch, who was talking about the importance of eradicating the snitch culture, getting people to come forward and talk. If that's demanded on the streets, why isn't it demanded of the officers themselves?
Well, first of all, we when a crime has been committed and an innocent person has been the victim of a serious crime, then we do call upon witnesses to come forward. We don't indict an entire community who may or may not have any knowledge of the crime for failing to give information.
But you do ask the community to come forward.
But in this case, Matt, there is strong evidence that no crime was committed. The evidence that they've relied on to even suggest that there may have been misconduct, again, has been tampered with in a very significant way. It's a fabrication.
So
calling upon the police to come forward and to give evidence against their fellows for an offense of which there is no evidence that it ever occurred.
So the officers
is kind of a moot point.
The officers might be cleared then if the other officers came forward. You understand the concerns that this might raise, though, within the public who are looking for accountability, who are looking to these sorts of investigations for accountability and looking for these investigations to answer some of the real questions that people have coming out of the G20.
Matt, there is no greater accountability placed upon any profession in our society than the police. We are subject to incredible oversight and scrutiny, as we should be. And as well, there is legislative frameworks for that oversight that clearly defines police officers' responsibilities and their rights, because they are also citizens. But they have, in exchange for the authorities that they possess, a great deal of accountability, and they have responsibilities to come forward. And for example, in an SIU investigation,
right,
a witness officer must make his notes and submit them for the use of the SIU, and he must submit to an interview within a relatively short time frame. It's to be forthwith. It usually takes place within 24 hours. I think that's not something we require of any other witness, but it's something always required of the police, and they did that in this case. When somebody is named as a subject officer, literally a suspect in a criminal investigation, the legislation also says that they have to submit their notes, but they don't have to submit to a statement. And so they exercised that right. But I think it's also important to recognize
briefly,
the SIU is not investigating a crime. They're trying to determine if a crime took place.
Mm-hmm.
What they relied on in this case to suggest that a crime took place is a fabrication. And so you have to go back to the basic premise. Police officers were out there doing a tough job in very difficult circumstances, and notwithstanding thousands of videos pointed at them, notwithstanding six investigations by the SIU, the only corroboration of any of those allegations that they were able to find against the police was tampered evidence.
Bill Blair, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That's Bill Blair, Chief of Police for the City of Toronto. WikiLeaks, as you've been hearing, started rolling out another big batch of classified U.S. documents yesterday, diplomatic cables containing, among other things, unflattering assessments of many U.S. allies. The United States has quick to condemn the move, the sentiment echoed by other world leaders, including this country's foreign minister, Lawrence Cannon, who said the release was, quote, deplorable. This morning I spoke with Chris Alexander about that. He's Canada's former ambassador to Afghanistan and the Conservative candidate for Ajax Pickering. What do you make of what you have read thus far?
Well, they're genuine diplomatic cables, that's for sure, and some of them are quite frank. But I think there are two issues here. One is the whole question of the confidentiality of communications. You know, someone has broken a law by making them public, and someone has not planned well by putting them in a form that allowed this to happen.
Right.
But on the other hand, there are some important issues out there in the world whose profile will be raised by these leaks. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
It's interesting in looking at them. And I guess the real details in terms of what people had to say about Canada will come out in the next couple of days, although we're hearing that there's already comments about our inferiority complex. One of the things that you're learning is that there is a lot of work that goes on that you don't hear about on international issues, on countries like Iran, on countries like Afghanistan, on concerns that people might have about corruption in those countries. Mm. If that comes to the surface in an unvarnished sort of way, what's the effect on, say, our relations with Afghanistan?
Well, I think these are American diplomatic cables. Some of the of their interlocutors, the people they talk to, are going to have trouble trusting them and being as frank in the short term anyway as they were at the time these cables were written. But there's also, and I think some British commentators have pointed this out, an unintended consequence of this. A lot of these cables are extremely well written, and the penetration, the insight about different issues, as you say, Iran, the arms build up in the Gulf as Arab countries worry what to do with Iran, some of the complex issues surrounding Pakistan, changing political landscape in Turkey are extremely well done, I would say, and the United States should be proud of what its diplomats are putting out. Well, deeply concerned about the use to which these cables have been put.
What about the slaps to various countries? Again, there are very real concerns expressed within these cables about the British involvement in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this comment about inferiority complex, and we know that various diplomats have been calling each other, almost apologizing in advance
mm-hmm.
for what's going to be coming out. Doesn't that have a negative effect on how we as a global society get along?
It does, and it's it's embarrassing. I don't think many of these judgments are unheard of. It's just shocking to see them there in black and white. And obviously, as you say, for diplomacy to continue, the system that underpins international relations around the world, confidentiality has to be assured, because no one is going to send their candid assessments if they're worried about them getting onto the internet as easily as these have.
What does it say about how diplomacy works when you have kind of nasty words being said back and forth, but also allegations of illicit operations, spying by some people who may not have been classified as spies? What does that say about what happens beneath the surface that we average people don't see?
Mm. Well, that is perhaps one of the most worrying revelations, if there are revelations here, that diplomats may have been asked to obtain some personal information about leaders in the United Nations. I was an official there
mm-hmm.
that you wouldn't normally expect diplomats to be looking for. But again, those in the business won't find it particularly scandalous.
No, but I'm not worried about people in the business. I'm worried about the average person who then is even more suspicious of a country's actions.
Yes, I think they have reason to be wondering what their government is up to.
Mm.
But at the same time, look at the threats that are described in these cables, and it's going to take energetic diplomacy on the part of the United States and other countries to come to grips with some of these issues and prevent conflicts from arising in the Horn of Africa, in various parts of the Middle East and elsewhere. So that's one of it's the urgency of these issues that in many ways is driving that more aggressive form of diplomacy.
We have just a couple of seconds left. Are you suggesting that perhaps the release of these is not as, quote, deplorable as Lawrence Cannon, the Canadian foreign minister, has suggested?
No, I think it is deplorable. And as I said earlier, it breaks U.S. laws.
But it does bring the discussion to a frank level that we haven't had in past.
It does, but I think there are appropriate ways of doing that that would actually reinforce the system. There is an access to information process that actually works for a lot of issues when it's not put under massive pressure. And we also need public diplomacy. We need governments to be telling us, including the U.S. government, what they're seeing out there, what is bothering them, and engaging the public on a more regular basis. That would actually help more than these leaks.
Certainly makes for fascinating reading. Chris, good to talk to you as always. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
That's Chris Alexander, this country's former ambassador to Afghanistan, talking about WikiLeaks. Last week on Metro Morning, I was talking about Maharaja, the Splendor of India's Royal Courts. An extraordinary new exhibition at the Art Gallery of Ontario features art and artifacts from India's royal families. Also includes a much-discussed gold Rolls-Royce, stunning diamond necklace, and some amazing photos and paintings from inside the world of the Maharajas, as well as some pretty cool furniture. And the throne of Ranjit Singh, the first king of the Sikh Empire. Now, given Toronto's very extensive South Asian communities, you might assume that the show would have great appeal across the GTA. Creating that is the job of a woman named Hema Sivanation. She's the Toronto curator and executive director of the South Asian Visual Arts Centre, and she was brought in specifically by the AGO for this project. I spoke with her this morning on Metro Morning. What is your job within this exhibition?
I've had a very interesting job working at the AGO on this exhibition. I've worked between the curatorial side of things, so helping to get some of those loans that you mentioned, the project management side of things, so making sure that everything arrives and so on, and working with the community. So that's been a big part of what I've been doing.
How have you been reaching out to those communities in particular?
You know, the AGO has made a real effort to get out and reach communities. We actually worked with a community advisory committee. So we actually brought on board a number of leaders in the community to work with us and give us feedback and advice through the whole process. We've also worked, we've had a community blog, for example. So we've built in a sort of lead time to get the community aware of the project and involved in different ways. We've got some volunteer ambassadors on board as well who'll be inside the exhibition and talking about their personal connection to things. So we've worked in many different ways to involve the community.
How do you do it? And do you have to be careful of doing it in a way that doesn't seem tokenistic or patronizing, not saying, look, here, we have some cool things from India, come and see them, that in a way that actually speaks to the community itself?
Absolutely. I think that's really important. And I think bringing in that personal voice and personal connections to the things in the exhibition is part of that. But as the director of the AGO has been making very clear, it's also, I think, the role of public institutions to go out and outreach to diverse communities. And, of course, Toronto is very proud of its diversity. And also working in ways, I think something very interesting for the AGO is that it actually has to change the way that the AGO functions.
What do you mean?
Well, Matthew Teitelbaum, the director of the AGO, has been very clear that an exhibition like this has to change the institution. And I think that's a very interesting proposition. So it's bringing in new audiences. It's a very different kind of exhibition for the AGO. So I think for it not to be tokenistic, there has to be a sort of consistency as well as a commitment to future programming and cultivating a different kind of community at the AGO.
You are a curator. You work within the role within the world of South Asian art in this city. How important is that for you to see an institution sort of change its approach and open its doors even wider?
I think it's enormously important. And I work for an organization called SAVAC, and it's been around for, you know, 16 years. And for an for a small organization like this to see a big institution begin to take on this kind of role where it's seeing that it has to address the diversity in the city and begin to sort of acknowledge the different cultures who make up the city of Toronto, I think it's very, very important and very timely.
What's the reaction been like from that outreach? I mean, I know that the exhibition just opened, but in terms of the people that you've spoken to and in terms of the people that you've seen through it, what have you seen?
Oh, the response has been incredible, and it's certainly brought many different kinds of people through the door who are coming to the AGO for the first time. And I think it's quite extraordinary because not only are they coming to see this exhibition, but they're also coming to spend time at the AGO and they're seeing the diversity of art from Canada as well that's at the AGO.
And is that key that it's not just about this? I mean, obviously that's going to get people through the doors and that's great for the bottom line of the art gallery, but that it is a long-term sort of project?
I think it really has to be. I think it has to change the community around the AGO as well and bring many different people and cultures together at an institution like the AGO.
One of the things that you pointed it, I was lucky enough to walk through this exhibition with you, was that within the exhibition itself, you're reminded of the diversity within this community, that it's not the quote-unquote South Asian community that mm-hmm. exists here or around the world, that there's a lot of different parts to that community, and there are many different communities that fall under that umbrella. Why is that important to stress?
I think it's very important because I think even amongst the South Asian community, we're not always very aware of each other's cultures.
That's interesting.
That is very interesting. And I think for the AGO to position this exhibition in this way, where you're actually bringing the diversity of South Asian cultures together. And we found this even with the Community Advisory Committee, that people bring their own cultural knowledge and cultural backgrounds to the table. And to sit together and actually learn from each other has been a very, very important exercise.
It's difficult to make institutions change, though. I mean, and I know that you're working there, and I don't want it seem as though it's a slight against it, but it is really hard to open a door, especially for something like a gallery or a museum that's rooted in one style or one philosophy, to suddenly say, or over time to say, listen, this is, yes, who we are, but we are also in a city that is very, very broad and changing all the time. And to do that is a real struggle.
I think you're right, actually, and it takes a long time, and I think it needs to come from the top as well. Mm. So it's, small steps, but I think they're very important steps.
It's a wonderful exhibition, but I thought the work that you're doing there and trying to take this exhibition and take this place to different communities is really worth talking about as well. Thanks for coming in.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
That's Hema Sivanathan, Special Projects Assistant for Maharaja, The Splendor of India's Royal Courts. It's on now at the Art Gallery of Ontario. Now, as you're hearing in the news, the Canadian actor Leslie Nielsen has died. He was born in Saskatchewan, had been suffering from pneumonia. He was 84 years old, was best known for his hilarious one-liners in films like Airplane and The Naked Gun, one-liners like these.
Doctors say he's got a 50-50 chance of living, though there's only a 10% chance of that.
Wilma, I promise you, whatever scum did this, not one man on this force will rest for 1 minute until he's behind bars. Now let's grab a bite to eat.
Yeah, come on, Wilma.
You'd better tell the captain we've got to land as soon as we can. This woman has to be gotten to a hospital.
A hospital? What is it?
It's a big building with patients, but that's not important right now. Tell the captain I must speak to him.
Certainly.
Captain, how soon can you land?
I can't tell.
You can tell me, I'm a doctor.
No, I mean, I'm just not sure.
Or can't you take a guess?
Well, not for another 2 hours.
You can't take a guess for another 2 hours?
That's the late, great Leslie Nielsen. He died yesterday of complications from pneumonia. He was 84 years old. That's your podcast for Monday. Full details of anything you hear on this program on our website, cbc.ca/metromorning. We're on Facebook. If you go to facebook.com/metromorning, you can become one of our friends and learn more about the program. Of course, we're also on Twitter, @MetroMorning. My name is Matt Galloway. Back tomorrow. Have yourself a great day.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.